In the years following World War II, a great wave of fear swept across the United States as its former ally, the Soviet Union, began to install puppet regimes across Central and Eastern Europe. The House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, assumed the task of purging the United States of communists, beginning with looking into the possibility that the American Communist Party had infiltrated the Works Progress Administration, including the Federal Theater Project and the Federal Writers Project. In Red Apple, Communism and McCarthyism in Cold War New York, Philip Deary, a professor of history at Victoria University in Melbourne, explores the human consequences of that Red Scare in New York City. It's published by Empire State Editions, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Deary to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
Well, you are an Australian. How is this time in American history remembered in your country?
With not quite as quite the degree of hostility. McCarthyism down under, as it was known, was experienced in with less severity than it was in the United States.
Despite the fact that your country is a lot closer to China than the United States is?
Well, many Australian politicians were ambivalent about the issue of China. The British Labor government had recognised China in 1950, and so many of the government ministers were divided over the state of recognition. It was really much later, during the Vietnam War, that the fear of China became more intense.
Mm-hmm. And communism wasn't a big issue in Australia?
Oh, yes, it was a big issue. Yes, it was a big issue. I was really just saying that it didn't have quite the severity of the McCarthyist period in America. There was an attempt, and it very narrowly succeeded, to ban the Communist Party, to declare it illegal, which wasn't done in America. The closest was the Communist Control Act, to ban the Communist Party in 1950 through legislation and 1951 through referendum. So, yes, it was an issue.
Well, we were sending communists to jail through the Smith Act.
Yes, exactly. Well, in Australia, the book isn't, of course, a comparative book.
I understand. In fact, we'll get to the United States the next question.
But people in communists in Australia were jailed under the Sedition Act for making seditious utterances. So it was a kind of equivalent of the Smith Act.
Well, how did you wind up becoming interested in American Cold War history?
Well, I've long been interested in that period, the Cold War, and I did comparative studies between Australia and Great Britain. And in 2002, I got a fellowship at NYU under the rubric of Cold War as Global Studies. So that propelled me on this path, and it's become a bit obsessional.
Well, we talk about this as the Red Scare period, but hadn't there been an earlier Red Scare following the Russian Revolution?
Yes, certainly. And most people would recall associate it with the Palmer Raids and attempts to deport people such as Emma Goldman. Though this period was more protracted, it was more severe, and in my view, it did more damage than that so-called first Red Scare immediately after World War One.
Well, the House Un-American Activities Committee was formed in, 1936? So that's in a period where the United States was more concerned about Hitler, or were we equally concerned about Hitler and Stalin?
Yeah, well, the before it became a permanent House Committee, House Un-American Activities, which was 1945, it had operated in a context of lack of support from the Roosevelt administration. It transformed itself into the Dyes Committee, which in effect performed the same sort of function. The concern then was with Stalin, but it didn't have a great deal of purchase. It was only as early as 1945 that the HUAC, let's call it, really found its feet.
Although after he became the HUAC chairman, Martin Dyes received a telegram from the Ku Klux Klan that said, "Every true American, and that includes every Klansman, is behind you and your committee in its effort to turn the country back to the honest, freedom-loving, God-fearing Americans to whom it belongs." And it's ironic that in 1946, the committee actually considered opening investigations into the Ku Klux Klan, but decided against it.
Yeah. The HUAC consisted of Dixiecrats. Many of the leading lights on that, Rankin and so on, I won't identify
Rankin
them.
Rankin was from Mississippi.
Yeah, that's right, were Southern Democrats. and their approach to communism was vicious and even virulent.
And of course, and Rankin remarked that he couldn't call the KKK anti-American because, after all, it was an old American institution.
That's right. So there was some affinity with that sort of nativism between the members of the KKK and those on the HUAC. Yeah.
My guest is Philip Deery, D-E-E-R-Y. His book, Red Apple, Communism and McCarthyism in Cold War New York. It is published by Fordham University Press, Empire State Editions. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the original investigations, as I said earlier, were about the possibility that the Communist Party of USA had infiltrated the Works Progress Administration, mm-hmm. the Federal Theater Project, and the Federal Writers Project, all of which were big programs in New York City. Did they find any evidence that these organizations were being used as a means to overthrow the U.S. government? Mm.
Well, that, of course, isn't the focus of the book, which is more the post-war period. But during the 1930s, there was ample circumstantial evidence that the Theatre Works Project was performing sort of front activity. It was a very short...
I mean, Waiting for Lefty was a commie play?
Clifford Odets wasn't a member of the Communist Party, but certainly many of the, when the Cradle Rocks and so on, were seen as potentially subversive. It's a big step between being seen as potentially subversive and being a threat to national security, which, of course, it wasn't. That changed with the investigation, and this is where the book first begins, into the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee.
You chronicle lives and experience of people who were affected by the Red Scare. Some, like Howard Fast, were still well-known. Others, like Dr. Edward Barsky and O. John, is it Rock?
Yeah, Roggy, as Rocky. In Foggy.
They're not. How did you decide which people to profile?
Mm. It was rather their connection with the Spanish Civil War, with the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, which is very much now slid from public memory, and the other mechanism that I used to look at Cold War New York and which connected many of these people was the so-called Waldorf Conference. The full title was the Cultural and Scientific Conference for World Peace held at the Waldorf Astoria in 1949. So all of these characters were connected with each other and with that conference or that organization.
The Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee.
Sorry?
The Joint Anti-Fascist yeah. Refugee Committee. Well, that was the Spanish Civil War was controversial in this country, which side to take. But many Americans were proud that they had joined the Lincoln Brigade. And Eleanor Roosevelt donated money to that cause. So, what was the problem?
Good question. While you can almost assume that opposition from Catholic Americans would be axiomatic because of the dividing lines between the Republicans and the Francoists in Spain. J. Edgar Hoover, and I found this astonishing memo, J. Edgar Hoover believed that the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade were not only trained in the use of military techniques, but prepared to use guns. So he thought in the context of any future war, presumably with the Soviet Union, as soon as World War II finished, they would be in the front line. Given the alliance between the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, whose raison d'etre was the Spanish Civil War and helping refugees from that, he deemed it subversive and, more than that, a threat to national security.
He thought that they would pick up arms and then try to overthrow the U.S. government?
Fanciful as that may now
despite
seem.
Despite the fact that the U.S. had had the world's most powerful war machine by that time?
Yes, but the fear of internal subversion was a very strong one.
And we get phrases like premature anti-fascists from this period.
Yeah.
These people were anti-fascists. We had just fought the war against fascism.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet these people were still suspect because they had been against fascism before it became the US policy?
That's right. So even at a time when America was neutral, and as a parenthetical note, one of the great regrets of FDR's life was that his government didn't intervene to support the Republicans. So even though there was a policy of neutrality, the FBI was forever circling the returning veterans from there. So once committed to that side, the Republican side, the brush of communism continued to tar them.
Well, during World War II, the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was licensed by President Roosevelt's War Relief Control Board to distribute aid and was granted tax-exempt status.
So it had, as you're implying, Leonard, a significant degree of respectability. And what it was concerned with was sheltering, housing, educating, sometimes schooling the children or the refugees themselves from that. And they were spread diversely from the foothills of the Pyrenees in France through to Mexico.
So we're bringing a lot of people over from Spain?
Yes, yes, and assisting.
Because there were concentration camps set up for Spanish refugees in France.
That's right.
And eventually they were dispersed, so they wound up in Mexico.
Yes, yes.
How many of them wound up in the United States?
It would be within the United States, probably very few. But in the diaspora was a very extended one. So quite a few were in Mexico, sort of following Trotsky's footsteps.
And some went to Cuba.
That's
because
right.
Because I had a friend who
came to
Cuba and then from Cuba was able to come to the United States.
Yeah, and the most important thing was Spanish-speaking, so going to Spanish-speaking countries, obviously.
How do we – I don't want to keep on saying the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. Is it JAFRIC? Is that how it's –
Yeah, yeah.
It was led by Dr. Edward Barsky. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he was a surgeon at Beth Israel Hospital. He was inspired by the attempt by the Republican army, the Republican forces in Spain, to create a new world, a better order. And so he mobilized, just quickly, he mobilized some doctors to go to Spain in 1937 and develop various medical techniques which were implemented there and which were used subsequently. When he came back, he mobilized the various groups into the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, which was formed in 1942. So it was going along very nicely until HUAC swooped in 1945 and Barsky himself was in the front line. He, and this is what he was jailed for ultimately, although you may be about to ask this, he refused, as did the entire executive board of the committee, he refused to hand over the records, not just the financial records, but the names of the refugees to whom money and support was being sent, so that was potentially lethal in the hands of the FBI, refused to hand over those records to HUAC. And for that, he and all the executive members were charged with contempt.
But JAFRIC, as we said, was a recognized non-profit humanitarian aid organization, and it had the support of some pretty famous people, Leonard Bernstein, Albert mm-hmm. Einstein, Langston Hughes, Orson Welles. Did the FBI and HUAC come to believe that they also were a threat to the United States?
Well, that didn't matter. There are a lot of organizations which were either proscribed or on the Attorney General's list of subversive activities, which had impeccable credentials and supporters who were highly respectable. So with this.
Well, in theory, of course, it was legal to be a communist in this country. Do we know whether Dr. Edward Barsky was a communist?
Yes, he was a communist. He was not a devoutly loyal apparatchik. He wasn't one of the hard men, if you like, of the Communist Party. There was an immense charisma as well as a generosity of spirit. People who worked with him just worshipped him, but not in the same way that they would have worshipped other communists may have worshipped Earl Browder or later William Z. Foster, whose politics, as I describe in the book, were as hard as granite.
Well, you mentioned that Dr. Barsky and also Helen Reed Bryan, who was JAFRIC's administrative secretary, refused to turn over the records. Was this a matter of principle, or were they trying to hide something?
Well, they were concerned, not without justification, that were the records to go to HUAC, which had an organic working relationship with the FBI, that both the donors within America and the recipients in Spain or Mexico or Cuba would suffer, at the very least, some kind of persecution. So that was their main concern.
Did they give the give HUAC anything?
No, nothing whatsoever. And for that, all were charged with contempt.
And we'll come back to that after we take a little break. My guest is Philip Deary, professor of history at Victoria University in Melbourne, where he teaches American and Cold War history. And he has written a book called Red Apple, Communism and McCarthyism in Cold War, New York. It is published by Fordham University Press in the Empire State Editions imprint. Stay with us for more. We're back with Philip Deary, D-E-E-R-Y. His book, Red Apple, Communism and McCarthyism in Cold War New York, published by Fordham University Press in the Empire State Editions imprint. And I'm really fascinated by the photo on the cover of the book. These are people who are picketing as anti-communists. They were not defending the people you're writing about, but rather saying things like, why don't the Reds move to USSR paradise? One has Shostakovich jump through the window. I guess that's something that would require a book in itself to explain. But and then another one, Stalin wants peace. He wants a peace here, a peace there, a peace everywhere.
Now, all these demonstrators were outside the Waldorf Astoria Hotel at the time of the so-called Waldorf Conference. Shostakovich was a reluctant and very anguished participant. He was, in fact, ordered by Stalin to attend. Stalin rang him up, and this is not apocryphal, Stalin rang him up at his dacha, and he thought he was joking. How can Stalin be on the other end of the line? And said, why have you refused Molotov's request to go to New York? But they're not playing my music there. We'll change that. The next day, his symphonies were being played on Russia, and so he had no rationale not to go. And it was one of the most distressing experiences in his life, according to Shostakovich in his memoirs. He actually feared that he may lose his life when he returned, as so many Jewish sort of composers, poets and so on had lost their lives in that period. This is the period of the doctor's plot. This is the period of Isaac Pfeffer disappearing and so on. So those demonstrators were mostly from what you'd call White Russians or Eastern Europe, the Baltic countries, who were mobilized by various organizations, some Catholic organizations, to protest and hold up those placards outside the Waldorf. And it was insistent for the whole period of the conference they were there.
And what was the conference about?
It was to ostensibly, and I think rather naively, to establish more friendly relations between scientists and artists and members of the literati between the United States and the Soviet Union. So that's why Shostakovich was there as a musician. And he was, of course, the draw card. But at this conference, many of our sort of usual suspects from the Communist Party and those mentioned earlier in the book either sponsored or spoke at or supported the conference. And so that's where the connections come in.
But Dr. Barsky wound up going to prison, didn't he, because he was convicted of contempt of Congress?
Yes. There were a series, 3 years of legal appeals against that contempt charge, and he went to prison along with the other executive board, which, by the way, was the largest mass incarceration since the Palmerites, which we mentioned before, and the biggest single one during the McCarthy period. But that was in 1950. So they were still able to attend the Waldorf conference, which is March 49.
And when he got out of prison, was he able to return to his medical practice?
That's one of the tragedies of his life, and I think underscores the vindictiveness of McCarthyism. Once he got out and he assumed that he'd returned to his practice, he was a very widely loved and respected surgeon at Beth Israel. His license to practice medicine was revoked, and no matter how many times he appealed and gathered together supporters, that remained in force for several years.
So McCarthy and Huac had influence with the New York State Board of Regents, which are responsible for issuing medical licenses?
No, and I'm not suggesting in the book that there's any cabal or or sort of conspiracy between Joe McCarthy, the Senate Investigatory Committees, and a whole range of public and professional and private institutions. But what there was, and this is the nature of McCarthyism, it's a mindset which operates in tandem with, but not necessarily in collusion with each other.
In 1952, the Treasury Department revoked Jaffrack's tax-exempt status, demanded that they pay $350,000 in back taxes?
Correct. Those are the IRS, isn't it? So that underscores the bureaucracy of repression.
And the HUAC requested that, or is this just something everybody was taking it upon themselves to say, okay, I'll join in on this?
It's a good question. I haven't uncovered any evidence that there's any, or on paper at least, that there's any instruction from Senator McCarthy's committee or from HUAC. But it was rather, as I was saying before, that the general shift, including the Justice Department and so on, in pinning down any organisation. And it not only pinned down Jaffa, it crippled it, because that inability to pay those back taxes back was in fact the last straw.
Now, the HUAC went after different kinds of people than McCarthy. They're the House, he's the Senate. They tended to focus on artists, or is that just what we now think of because of the Hollywood blacklist?
Yeah,
people like Ilya Kazan.
Yeah, no, there's no
Arthur
particular
Miller.
Profession. Yeah, that's right. There's no particular profession. It was who was called before and so on. Howard Fast, or as the Americans and probably you would say, Fast. Howard Fast.
That's exactly what we would say. Howard Fast
was.
He had a bestseller, Citizen Tom Paine.
That's right, and he was hauled before the Senate Investigatory Committee, and not before HUAC in this case.
Now he was an open communist. Later left the party because of Stalin's policies regarding Jews.
Mm. It was a gradual process in which his awareness of Soviet anti-Semitism was one factor. He became increasingly aware of that when a great many Soviet poets, Jewish poets, writers disappeared, and he simply wasn't corresponding with them. There's one, perhaps, anecdote that illustrates that, and that sort of conundrum between being both Jewish, and he was a secular Jew, and an active, until 56, member of the Communist Party. He went to a reception at the Soviet embassy in Manhattan, and he asked the embassy official there about the fate of Isaac Pfeffer. Isaac Pfeffer was a famous Russian poet who'd famously met Paul Robeson in a Moscow hotel room in 1949, and the rumours that he'd been executed. And the Soviet official said, "Howard, why do you worry about Jews? Jews, that is all we hear from you. Do you think Stalin killed no one else but Jews?" But Howard managed, until 56, to keep his doubts and his misgivings private. And then, post-Stalin's revelations about Stalin, Khrushchev's secret speech, they exploded. And perhaps, going back to your original question, perhaps because of the evidence in Khrushchev's speech of systematic Soviet anti-Semitism, his response was one of intense, I can't emphasise that too much, of intense grief and anger and anguish.
Wasn't Fast also on the board of directors of JAFRAC?
Yes, he was.
Did he go to jail too?
Yes, he went to jail in 1950 along with the rest, and his jail mate, or companion rather, was Dick or Lyman Bradley, another person who features in the book, an NYU German professor, professor of German.
Now, he had had a bestseller with Citizen Tom Paine. Did his experiences with HUAC affect the sales of the book? And his next book, that, or one of his books that many people think was also a bestseller, Spartacus, which he had to self-publish, didn't
he? Yeah, that's right, that's right. Well, Citizen Tom Paine was already out before HUAC was swooping on JAFRA. He encountered the first problem when the New York Board of Schools withdrew it from public from circulation, so state students couldn't then get access to it. So that was in as early as 1947.
So it was being banned from libraries.
Yeah, so it had been banned from school, public libraries and school libraries. And then, yeah, as you said, Spartacus, which he later became renowned after Stanley Kramer. Stanley Kubrick, rather. Kramer had a first go at it, I think, and then Kubrick made it into a famous film. But that he had to publish by himself. It's a self-publishing outfit, which was extraordinarily difficult. What's it called? Blue Heron Press. And the reason it's self-publishing, because the mainstream publishers, including his stable publisher, Little Brown, wouldn't touch it, and that was because of the of his imprisonment and of HUAC's investigation into JAFRA. Yeah,
and it is ironic that the film of Spartacus actually helped break the Hollywood blacklist.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And people like...
Because Dalton Trumbo was given film credit, even though before then he'd been forced to use pseudonyms for scripts that he was writing.
Yes, yes. There was, just it's a sidelight, which I don't go into in the book, that there was there was no love lost between Dalton Trumbo and Howard Fast, because he maintained that it was he, not Trumbo, who wrote most of the screenplay. But Trumbo certainly eventually took the credit. There's a certain narcissism about Howard, but that's another story.
Well, you don't have to be a good person to have been unjustly sent to prison for having been involved in what was legal activity until it was suddenly decided that it was no longer legal activity.
Mm, precisely.
What happened with the attorney, JAFRAC's attorney, Ojan Rogi? Was he a communist?
No, not at all. In fact, he tried to run as Henry Wallace's running mate in 1948. So he's closely connected with the Progressive Party. Rogge is a story of two halves. The first half, up to 1950, he was very much on the progressive side, and that's why JAFRA got his services as a lawyer. Very much a man on the left, devout about upholding civil liberties and so on. And I think it was his prediction that America would become fascist that forced the Communist Party, decided the Communist Party to go underground. After 1950, it's a different story. He seems to have swapped sides. Indicative of that was his defence of David Greenglass, who, of course, turned Crown prosecution witness against Ethel Rosenberg and Julius Rosenberg. Ethel Rosenberg, as most of your listeners would know, was David Greenglass's sister. Mm. And his testimony, probably more than any other factor, sent them to the electric chair. So Rogge was certainly not a communist. In fact, he was called Rogge the Rat, quite memorably, by W.E.B. Du Bois, when he took on Du Bois as the chairman of this Peace Information Center in 1951.
So he recovered in a way, but most of these other people that you write about, their lives were ruined forever?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Those who sort of were at war within themselves, Rogge was one, and and Howard Fast was another, emerge in the later 1950s as very troubled psychologically people. The other people that I talk about, their careers were stymied, their professional lives were crippled, but they remained steadfast in their faith. Their faith had been a sort of a bulwark against the inroads that the FBI and the top-level informants program, the top-lev program, had tried to persuade them to come over to the other side.
Later, J. Edgar Hoover became convinced that civil rights activists were working for the communist cause, but that's the next part of this story.
That's right. Although we often associate the civil rights activism with COINTELPRO. That was actually formed during our period, and it was mobilised against when Howard Fast defected in 1957. Yeah.
Philip Deary is a professor of history at Victoria University in Melbourne, Australia, where he teaches American and Cold War history. And he has written a book called Red Apple, Communism and McCarthyism in Cold War New York, about its impact on people who lived in this city, affected kind of like the way Hollywood was, more than the rest of the country, published by Fordham University Press.